From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Floating format for you tonight, the Crowded Universe with Alan Boss starts in just moments. While I don't have to tell some of you just how bad it is out there these days, others, well, you're fortunate enough to be working and you're doing okay. But the U.S. economy is suffering its steepest downturn since at least the 1970s and could descend into a depression, says Jeff Immelt, the General Electric chief executive. He said the businesses and consumers alike were struggling to contend with incredible markets and a financial services industry under siege. Unlike the other downturns that have been part of his existence, Mr. Immelt says that GE, at a conference, said that once you break through the years of 74 and 75 in that situation, you won't stop until you get to 1929. A bipartisan group of senators sounded less optimistic after ending a second meeting on the economic stimulus bill Thursday than they had at the end of the first one. Senators Ben Nelson, Democrat, and Republican Susan Collins said they are having a difficult time finding the right balance of cutting some Democratic-backed programs while adding spending on infrastructure, which the Republicans want. Two Democratic senators said the bipartisan group has found general agreement to cut about $100 billion from the nearly $900 billion plan. Collins had said earlier that President Obama had convinced her of the need for a plan that would cost about $800 billion. An earthquake that killed at least 80,000 people in China last year may have been triggered by an enormous dam just miles from the epicenter, man-made. The 511-foot-high dam holds 315 million tons of water, lies just 550 yards from the fault line, 3 miles from the epicenter of the earthquake. Well, now scientists in China and the United States believe that the weight of the water and the effect of it penetrating into the rock could have affected the pressure on the fault line underneath, possibly unleashing a chain of ruptures that led to the quake. Geologist Jim Berkland suspended from his geology job when he made a major earthquake prediction in 1989. Jim, do you think this is possible?
Absolutely. They're finally coming around to what I said in 1975. Now, anybody getting my newsletter, my monthly newsletter, which I'm just starting my 20th year of putting it out, would in May, I had predictions for May. The seismic window of May 4th to 11th, 2008, is based upon the new moon of May 5th and the very close perigee just 15 hours later. This perigean spring tide is one of only four this year, and the Golden Gate maximum daily range in tides will be twice normal on May 7th. I'm 80% confident that one or more quakes will hit this window with the following parameters. I said one would hit within 140 miles of Mount Diablo, and we got 3.2 at the geysers and a 3.8 near Reno, which was just within the 140 miles. And then I predicted the same range of 3.5 to 6 in Southern California and got a 3.7 near Lake Henshaw on the 4th. And Lake Isabella, well, that one was on the 1st, so I missed that one. But there was a 4.1 at Anza on the 9th.
Well, did we need the conditions to be right in China for this to happen, or would it have happened anyway?
The reservoir certainly helped to advance that big quake. It was a 7.8 to 8, originally called an 8, and it was on the 11th of May, on the last day of my window. So this is my windows tell people when, but they don't tell you exactly where or how big, so you have to look for local symptoms. Now, if the Chinese had been paying attention to all those frogs running in the streets before the quake and the pandas,
I remember that.
The pandas were upset. If they put that together with the extreme tides and then understood that reservoir-induced seismicity is reality.
Jim, they say snakes are very sensitive, too.
Yes, indeed. I don't know if they were calling out at that point, but they certainly did before the 1975 Haicheng quake.
While we have you, give us a prediction for the next month or so.
Oh, yes. Well, we have an eclipse of the moon on the 9th of February, just coming right up. And back on the 9th of February, 1971, we got the San Fernando earthquake.
Please spell your website.
It's SYZYGYJOB.com.
All right.
And if they want a sample copy of my newsletter, send me a self-addressed stamped envelope with a couple of bucks in it to P.O. Box 1926, Glen Ellen, California. That's G-L-E-N, capital E-L-L-E-N. And the zip code is 95442. I'll be happy to send them a late copy.
All right. We'll get very close to you as we get to this next window. A recording of the communications between air traffic controllers and a pilot of a U.S. Airways Airbus, which ditched into New York's Hudson River, has now been released. The pilot is heard calmly telling controllers the aircraft had been struck by birds. Asked if he can return to the airport, he answers, unable.
Cactus 1539 hit birds. We've lost thrust on both engines, returning back towards LaGuardia.
Okay, you need to return to LaGuardia. Turn left, heading up 220.
220.
Tower, stop your departure. He's got emergency returning. It's 1529. Bird strike. He lost all engine. He lost the thrust in the engines. He's returning immediately.
Cactus 1529. Which engines?
He lost thrust in both engines, he said.
Got it.
Cactus 1529. We can get it for you. Do you want to try to land 1313?
We're unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
All right, Cactus 1549. It's going to be left traffic to runway 31.
Unable.
Okay, what do you need to land? Cactus 1549. Runway 4 is available if you want to make left traffic to runway 4.
Hey, the echo field. I'm not sure we can make any runway. What's over to our right? Anything in New Jersey? Maybe Teterboro?
Okay, yeah, off your right side is Teterboro Airport. Do you want to try to go to Teterboro?
Yes.
Teterboro, Empire. Actually, LaGuardia departure guy, emergency inbound.
Hey, go ahead.
Cactus 1529 over the George Washington Bridge wants to go to the airport right now.
Wants to go to our airport. Check. Does he need assistance?
Yes. It was a bird strike. Can I get him in for runway 1?
Runway 1, that's good.
Cactus 1529, turn right 280. You can land runway 1 at Teterboro.
We can't do it.
Okay, which runway would you like at Teterboro?
We're going to be in the Hudson.
I'm sorry. Say again, Cactus. Cactus 1549, radar contact is lost. You also got Newark Airport up at 2 o'clock in about 7 miles. Eagle 5, 4718, turn left bank 210.
210, 4718. I think he said he was going in the Hudson.
And you know the rest. He went in the Hudson. All 155 passengers and crew of the flight 1549 survived January's landing on the river, which made headlines worldwide. Bill Gates, the billionaire founder of Microsoft and a renowned philanthropist, let loose a swarm of mosquitoes at a technology conference in California to highlight the dangers of malaria. Malaria is spread by mosquitoes, the Microsoft founder yelled at a crowd at a technology conference in California. I brought some here. I'll let them roam around. There's no reason only poor people should be infected. He opened up a jar, and these mosquitoes went all over the place. He let the shocked audience sweat for a minute or so before assuring them that the freed insects were malaria-free, but that didn't satisfy those in attendance. The founder of eBay, by the way, was very upset. He says, I'm not sitting up front anymore, but this is one of Bill Gates and his wife Melinda Gates' pet projects, donating hundreds of millions of dollars to develop a vaccine for malaria. The first evidence of how vitamin D deficiency and genetics interact to increase the risk of multiple sclerosis has been reported by researchers. A UK and Canadian team found that the vitamin D helps to control a gene to increase MS risk. It suggests that vitamin D supplements be taken during pregnancy and early in life to prevent the disease. A man in Croatia has lost 160 pounds in just 6 months on a diet of garlic and onions. When he hit 26, doctors told him he would die if he didn't lose the weight. He tried several diets without success, but then started living off the garlic and onions on just a plain biscuit with carrot juice. A pal of his says, gosh, he looks great, but his breath is really bad. I would guess so. Researchers have calculated that nearly 40,000 planets in our galaxy are hospitable enough to be home to creatures at least as intelligent as us, if we are. Astrophysicist Duncan Forgan created a computer program that collated all the data on the 330 or so planets known to man and worked out what proportion of it would have conditions suitable for life. In a moment, we talk with Alan Boss, The Crowded Universe on Coast to Coast AM. Alan Boss is a research staff member at the Carnegie Institution's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism up there in the northwestern part of Washington, D.C. Alan's theoretical research focuses on using three-dimensional hydrodynamics codes to model the formation of stars and planetary systems, and he's been helping NASA plan its search for extrasolar planets ever since 1988, continues to be very active in helping to guide NASA's efforts. Alan, welcome to Coast, my friend.
Thank you, George.
I am so glad that you are in our galaxy, because this is a great book, The Crowded Universe. You've done a super job on this.
Well, thank you, George.
You know, they just found another planet. Now, this one is almost Earth-like in terms of size, and that doesn't happen very often, does it?
That's true. We've only found a couple of dozen of so-called super-Earths so far. So the announcement by the French this week that the Crow satellite had found a planet with a mass perhaps somewhere between 5 and 11 times the mass of the Earth and a radius about 1.8 times the radius of the Earth is a really a marvelous discovery.
Alan, the search for life, why is it so important that we find planets Earth size as opposed to these giants?
Well, a lot of the planets have been found so far. You mentioned earlier roughly 330 planets have been found. Of those 330, roughly 300 of them are gas giants, rather similar to Jupiter or Saturn. And so those are perfectly hospitable places if you're on a moon around them, perhaps. If you happen to have the planet where it's in the habitable zone of the star where the moon could have liquid water, that might be a good place to live. But we really, of course, want to find something that looks pretty much like our own Earth, just because we are sort of Earth-centric. It's a little bit hard to go beyond simply just imagination and start thinking of what else we could live on. We know that a Earth-mass planet is the right distance from a sun-like star. If it has water, it can be a wonderful place to live. And so we at least want to make sure that we can find planets like that, that we'll find them and then have a good chance of knowing that's where life could be.
Alan, tell me a little bit about these gas giants, first of all. It's got a solid core somewhere down there, right?
That is the case, we believe, for Jupiter and Saturn. Certainly Saturn, the best estimates are that Saturn has something like maybe a 15 or a 20 Earth mass core. For Jupiter, though, the situation is a little bit more complex. The models that people make for the interior actually could allow Jupiter having no core at all, which would be a total surprise. On the other hand, the core of Jupiter could be perhaps as large as maybe 15 Earth masses. So that's a bit of a mystery as to why Saturn should have such a rather large core at this point and Jupiter does not. One possibility is that perhaps cores form early on and then they erode with time. So that what we see in Jupiter right now is not what it was like when it was first formed, but that it's somehow lost its core, which is what would be amazing if it's really true.
Okay, if that happened, what happened, do you think, to Jupiter? And is it really a planet?
It's a planet because, by definition, an object with a mass less than about 13 Jupiter masses, an object around a star, according to the International Astronomical Union, that object is called a planet by definition. So whether it has a core or not, if it's in orbit around a star and is not able to burn deuterium, that makes it a planet. If it's able to burn deuterium, which is an isotope of hydrogen, then it's called a brown dwarf because it's sort of closer to being a star than a planet. Stars burn hydrogen primarily to keep themselves shining, and a brown dwarf can burn deuterium for a few million years to keep itself shining, but a planet really doesn't have that source of energy at all to deal with, and so planets are, in that sense, dead. But if in orbit around the star, then they deserve to be called a planet, according to the IAU, at least.
Alan, what is keeping the gases that form Jupiter, basically, there? Why doesn't it just fling itself off into space?
Good point. It's the same reason that stars don't fall apart either. It's because they're held together by their own self-gravity. It's gravity which is holding the planet together. Same thing for the Earth, too. Of course, the Earth it's mostly rock and a bit of water and a little bit of gas, but primarily rock. And those planets, basically any planet worthy of the name, is held together by gravity. And they manifest that by being round in shape. In fact, the roundness was at one time advanced as a serious criterion for what should be a planet rather than, say, a mass or something like that. But simply if it's a round body, thou shalt be a planet.
Now, in theory, will Jupiter ever, even though it may take billions of years, will it ever form into a very solid-type planet?
No. It's going to just slowly cool down a bit more. It's losing energy now from contracting down, and there's something, a process perhaps of a helium rainout onto the center of the planet. And we still don't really know, as I said, exactly what's going on with that core. The core is coming or it's going right now. But it's pretty much going to look like what it is now. It's just a little bit cooler as time goes out. Of course, it'll also be affected by the sun. And the sun, in another 5 billion years or so, expands to become a red giant star. Its luminosity will increase, and that will actually increase the temperature in which Jupiter finds itself. So it'll go through a few changes when the sun becomes a red giant star. But the sun's outer layers will not expand all the way out to where Jupiter is. The sun's outer layers will probably sweep past Venus's orbit and perhaps even the Earth and fry us here on Earth pretty well. But Jupiter should remain relatively unscathed as a result of that process.
Alan, the crowded universe, the search for living planets. What do you mean by living planet?
The hope is to find a planet which could have life on it. We have missions that we are planning on launching. In fact, there's one that will be launched by NASA just a little over a month from now, which will look for Earth-like planets. And the idea is to find a planet with roughly one Earth mass, which is orbiting at a distance from its star so they could have liquid water on or near its surface. And those are the preconditions that we believe are likely for life, essentially of any kind, certainly Earth-like life.
Tell me about the title, The Crowded Universe. What's it mean?
The point is that we are on the verge of finding out how many Earths there are in the galaxy. This mission that NASA is going to be launching in early March, March 5th, the Kepler mission from Cape Canaveral, is designed specifically to count the number of Earths that are in our galaxy. It'll do that by starting in a field of 100,000 stars in Cygnus for about four years or so and looking for how many stars are orbited by Earths by seeing if the stars blink when the Earths orbit in front of the stars and block some of their stars' light. And so when we find out from the Kepler mission just how frequently Earths are, maybe they're around 1% of stars, maybe 10% of stars, maybe essentially 100% of stars have Earth-like planets, that will give us a feeling for how many Earths are in the entire galaxy. The galaxy is something like 100 billion stars, and there's a good chance that of those 100 billion stars, essentially all of them have an Earth-like planet, which makes for a lot of Earths. So if you can imagine that essentially every star you look at when you look out on the night sky has an Earth-like planet, I think it's pretty hard for a lot of them not to have life.
I think this study of nearly 40,000 planets that could be hospitable to home creatures, I think that's kind of like, don't you?
I would call that a lower bound on
yeah.
habitable worlds, because I think it's more likely to number in the order of billions or so.
I think so, too. I think so, too. And we're going to get into a lot of that and what you think might be on some of those planets. Now, to date, we found about what? About 300 and so planets. How often are we finding them now?
The rate is increasing, mostly by the so-called transit method, the method that this NASA Kepler mission will be using. Those folks have a number of worldwide surveys that are spending, even as we speak, telescopes around the world right now are trying to find more transiting planets. And they are now discovering something like on the order of several dozen a year. And that rate is going to be increasing and will increase even stronger once the Kepler mission goes up, because Kepler will probably find hundreds of transiting planets. So we're in the phase where it's sort of explosive growth in the field. And just a little over 10 years ago, we had zero planets going outside the solar system. We now have 330 or so, and the rate is increasing. So within another couple of years, we should have 1,000.
You've been at this a number of years. Before we started finding and discovering these other planets, did you always believe deep down inside that there were planets out there?
I think that's a very common assumption by most astronomers. But we really didn't know how many there would be. As far as we knew, that there might only be one solar system to look like our own, and planets should be out there, but they could very well be quite rare. Maybe only 1% of stars, or 1 in 1,000, or 1 in 10,000 have planets. So it's been stunning to find out from direct astronomical observation in the last 10 years that at least 10 or 20% of stars have gas giants like Jupiter's, which are the ones which are easiest to find. And the other 80 or 90% might very well have Earths, but we just can't see them yet.
So. And what percent of the stars have planets at all around them then? Almost 100%?
Well, that's not proven yet, but
no.
The indications are that roughly 10 or 20% have Jupiter-like planets
right.
within Jupiter-like orbits. And those are the easiest ones to find. And the other 80%, we don't really quite know yet. But since Jupiters are kind of the hardest ones to form of all, you have to really make them quickly in order to get enough gas on them to make a gas giant. And we think that in a lot of cases, perhaps the planet formation process doesn't proceed fast enough to make the Jupiters. And so we think essentially all the other cases, there should be rocky planets around them, but not gas giants. So I would think there's a good case that essentially all stars have at least some planets around them.
Alan, the physics for our solar system and other star systems must be the same. We'll find out when we come back. Hey, Saturday and Sunday, the weekend of Valentine's Day, I'll be at the Conscious Life Expo here in Los Angeles for a two-day workshop event. And I guess Saturday night is a special dinner as well. If you need information on it, go to consciouslifeexpo.com or go to our website under the calendar schedule and just click that. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've got Alan Boss tonight. Alan, the laws of physics, are they the same in that what happens in our solar system is generally happening in other star systems as well?
That is what astronomers and physicists always assume, and to the extent that we make measurements of other things going on throughout the universe and the galaxy, there's never been any proof to show that that's not the case.
Now, what about the possibility of life on these other systems as well? If let's say water is abundant and the planet is relatively Earth-like close to its star, what are the odds of life then developing on that planet in some form or fashion?
I think it's essentially inevitable. If you have a planet which is sitting there for several billion years while its star is stably burning hydrogen on the main sequence, I think in such a world it would be hard to keep it sterile and to prevent it from evolving some sort of life. I think the process is essentially inevitable. That's not to say that you're necessarily going to end up with intelligent life like what we have, and certainly not necessarily having intelligent life that's around and sending us radio waves at the same time that we're able to receive them, but I think life of some form is going to be on any habitable world.
I would think, though, and this is coming from a non-scientist, that if you could find a planet like Earth, similarities, and, 4.5 billion years old, maybe it's 6 billion years old, there's probably a pretty high probability that if there's any life on it at all, it's going to evolve in some kind of similar fashion to this planet. I'm taking out spirituality for a moment because, there will be many who will talk about how we started. Let's take that out for just a second. Don't you think, it would have snakes and birds and fish and animals and creatures very similar to what we have?
I think there's a good chance of that, yeah. You have to remember, though, that multicellular life on Earth has only been around for the last maybe 500, 600 million years or so. For the first 3 or 4 billion years, the life that was around was more like slime mold in some sense. It's a simple bacteria, archaea, single cellular objects. And so that is probably what's going to be happening on most planets most of the time. But if you happen to be phased upright and get that right 500 million year period of time, then yes, you're likely to have more advanced life forms as well. I agree.
What do you think happened in that 500 million year period to jumpstart life the way we know it now?
I think that's just the basic process of evolution, that the single cellular creatures finally managed to get themselves together and make a few multicellular creatures, and that's when the evolution process really took off and found it had a lot more ways to evolve and form new creatures rather than simple single cellular objects.
And Alan, do you think it's the planet that determined what the creatures look like, or would they have turned out the way they are anyway, regardless of what planet they were on?
Boy, that's a tough one to say. There's a process called convergent evolution where scientists like Simon Conway Morris have pointed out that it's likely that evolution pretty much proceeds the same way everywhere, because within the fossil record on Earth, we can see, for example, where several different manifestations of living beings evolved independently. For example, the development of the eye. There are only several types of eyes that different creatures can evolve. And by and large, most creatures have developed the same sorts of eyes that we have as human beings. And so that's the idea, is that there's something, there's sort of a magic way or a preferred way of evolving. And that seems to be the case for various desperate life forms on the Earth. And so you would have to imagine that that same sort of process is going to occur on other planets, because we're talking about planets which are similar to the Earth. So by definition, they have the same sort of gravity, the same sort of solar insulation, same sort of temperatures, same amount of water, more or less. And so the conditions are, to first degree at least, pretty much the same. So I think, yes, one could make a case for having some sort of advanced life forms, which would not be identical to what we see on Earth, but they, on the other hand, there's this incredible diversity of life forms on Earth. Like, all of us have probably seen pictures of some strange animal we hadn't seen before. We thought, my God, is that real, or yeah. is that a creation of Hollywood?
Yeah.
And I think it's the same sort of thing. If someone sent us a textbook of their animals from another planet, and we looked at that textbook, they probably the variety of life we would see would be just as stunning as what we see on Earth. And some of the creatures, we might say, gosh, as far as I know, that thing might have crawled out of the Amazon jungle last week.
Why do we have such a variety of creatures on this planet? I mean, my gosh, they're all over the place, and they're all different. Similar, but different.
I think it's because we have a diversity of habitats here, from the deep sea to the high deserts, the Atacama Desert. I've been observing in Chile about a week or so ago, and the Chileans there were amazed that they found this rather large toad up on top of the mountain, which they hadn't seen in something like 30 years of being there. And this toad had colorations on his back, which made it look like he blended in perfectly with the rocks of the Atacama Desert. And here he was in the middle of no place. What in the world was a toad doing on top of this dry desert? So I think it's the fact that we have these quite incredible range of habitats that forces animals to find a niche where they can live, and they have to adapt to it. And that produces this wide range of possible creatures.
They found the fossil of a snake 42 to 45 feet long. They said it was as long as a bus, that it probably could eat a creature as big as a cow. I mean, gosh, what a planet, huh?
Yeah, thank goodness we're not around while that guy is still alive. I believe he was something like 65 to 70 million years or so.
Yeah.
We would not have wanted to met that fellow. Although I think some of the anacondas and pythons that are around even these days are, of course, they're not quite as large, maybe only 30 feet in length, but even that's a pretty scary creature to run into if you're walking in your backyard one night.
Did you ever know Carl Sagan?
I did indeed. In fact, I had written a first book called Looking for Earth, the Race to Find New Solar Systems, and Carl had kindly agreed to write the foreword for that book.
Okay.
And so he was involved in the process of understanding the first planets that had been found back in 1995. He was very much excited about that. He wrote a wonderful article for Parade Magazine and the Sunday Supplements in 95, early 96, which talked about the importance of this field of actually finding the first planet. So it was wonderful that he lived long enough to partake of this new age that we're in now for finding extrasolar planets. Unfortunately, though, he died in December of 1996, before I finished writing my book. And before we really were able to realize the immense wealth of what we're finding from extrasolar planet discoveries.
And he believed in the possibility that there could be intelligent life out there in the universe, though he didn't believe it had visited this planet. But he did open up his mind to that possibility that they could be out there, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He was a strong supporter of the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence programs. There's, in fact, an entire institute devoted to that process.
Good old SETI.
SETI, right. SETI, in fact, there, I believe that Jill Tarter is the Carl Sagan chair at the SETI Institute. And in fact, NASA has just recently acknowledged his importance for the field by renaming an important postdoctoral fellowship program the Carl Sagan Fellowship. So anyone who's basically trying to understand star and planet formation and astrobiology, the origin of life, and gets some money and gets an award from NASA to be a postdoctoral fellow, they are now called Carl Sagan Fellows, just starting this year.
Do you believe the universe is completed now in terms of developing new solar systems, developing planets? Is it finished and, now we just maintain, or is it still growing? Is it still creating?
Oh, no, goodness gracious, no. New stars are forming all the time within our galaxy, just within our own galaxy alone, as well as in other galaxies. So I don't think there are probably too many new galaxies are forming. There may be galaxies merging and over time, over the next
as we will.
Years. But within our own galaxy, we know that there are active regions of star formation going on right now. So there are new stars forming, new planetary systems forming, and new possible abodes for life that are just starting at T equals zero right now, and they will be evolving life over the next several billion years.
Why are they forming now and not 4, 5, 6 billion years ago?
Sure, that's a wonderful question. The reason is that stars don't live forever, at least especially the most massive stars. The masses of, you know, above 7 or 8 times the mass of the sun typically explode as supernova, and even lower mass stars blow out a lot of their mass in the form of gas and dust. Red giant stars are some of the primary producers of dust in the galaxy. And this gas and dust, which gets ejected back into the interstellar medium, passing around between the stars, this gas and dust collects in what are called giant molecular cloud complexes, which have typically 100,000 or more solar masses of gas and dust in them. And that's often where we find regions of active star formation. This gas and dust can then pull itself together again by self-gravity, or can be pushed together by shock waves from supernova or outflows from asymptotic giant branch stars, planetary nebula. All these objects can push gas and dust around in the interstellar medium. And once these clouds become self-gravitating, they can collapse down again and form a new star and start the process all over again. So it's a sort of an ongoing cycle. It's best thought of it as sort of an arrow connecting stars to growing old and expelling gas and dust, and then having new clouds form and forming new cycles of stars, and then the circle just goes round and around.
It is. It's truly amazing, isn't it?
It is. Well, we are literally stardust, of course.
Yeah.
Especially all of the elements in our body.
I knew I was old, Alan, but I didn't think I was that old. Huh?
I mean, we think of the sun as being roughly 4.5 billion years old, but some of the elements that are in us were probably formed from supernova that were quite a bit from several generations before then. So in some sense, we are all pretty much, everything in us, of course, including the hydrogen, which came out of the Big Bang, is roughly 13.7 billion years old. We are all equally old in that sense, a little bit.
It's kind of,
that's impressive, actually. I hadn't really thought of that.
It is kind of bizarre to think of it. I mean, we all start off the same age, basically.
Yes, we're all 13.7 billion, but then it's the last couple, six significant figures that's of most importance for people's life.
You know, the old saying, you can't ask a woman her age. Boy, how would you like to tell her she's 13.5 billion years old, huh?
Yeah, they're right, but we all are, so
get
who cares?
High heel in the back of the head or something like that. What fascinates you when you were putting the crowded universe together? Was there a specific area that just fascinated you, probably has fascinated you since you were a boy?
Well, I think the most important thing that came out of writing the book was the realization that the thesis of the book, that the universe was crowded, really was becoming even more true as I was writing the book. Because I started writing it a little over a year or so ago. It was only in the last year that people really began finding more and more of these super-Earths, like the one that was announced this week by the French Corona.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, well, one of the leaders of the field, Michel Mayor of the Geneva Observatory, his team found a planetary system with 3 super-Earths, with masses of maybe 4, 7, and 9 times the mass of the Earth. All 3 of them are around one star, which is just truly impressive. It's one thing to find a star with one of these guys, but to find a star which has 3 of these super-Earths, that's truly giving you the idea that nature likes to make these large rocky planets. And as part of that discovery, the Mayor also pointed out that based on their samples of stars they've looked at, that they think that probably at least 1/3 of stars have these rocky, hot super-Earths. And if that many, and those are the ones that are easy to find, more cooler, rocky planets like the Earth are probably there as well, but they can't really be seen yet because we don't have the technology to find them, generally speaking. So the implications are that essentially all stars have rocky worlds like Earth, and that really just became very clear in the last 8 months or so. And so that was during the process of writing the book, and one of these things where you start writing something, you get even more excited about it because the evidence is becoming stronger and stronger as you're writing.
What percent of these planets that are out there, the 330 or so, what percent do you think might have a moon attached to them?
So roughly, say, 300 of them are probably gas giants, and actually the super-Earths might very well have moons as well, and there are also ice giants that are analogous to Uranus and Neptune. So I would think that all 3 classes of planets, based on our experience in the solar system, have moons.
Huh.
Ice giants have moons, Earths have moon, Venus doesn't happen to have one because it probably ate its moon a long time ago. Mars has a couple of small moons, and certainly the Galilean satellites of Jupiter are spectacular. So I would suspect that based on, again, the solar system analogy, which is not that bad these days, I mean, we're beginning to think that solar systems are quite common, I would suspect that of those 330 on planets found to date, I would guess the majority of them have a few moons.
Do you think the moons are necessary for the planet's existence, basically?
I think the moons are a basic outcome of how planets form. In the case of rocky planets, they form by collisions between progressively larger and larger bodies.
Right.
And in the case of our own moon, we believe our moon was derived from a collision between the growing proto-Earth and a roughly Mars-sized impactor that came in and hit the Earth with a glancing blow. Didn't hit the Earth face-on, but hit with a glancing blow enough off it to the side so that some material sprayed out in orbit around the Earth and left behind a hot disk of dust and gas, which then coalesced and cooled down and formed the moon in orbit around the Earth.
Now, this glancing planet that hit us,
yep.
Where did it go?
It basically was gobbled up by the Earth. Most
okay,
of that,
so mass, the whole thing.
Yeah, yes, it all actually right. was adding its mass to the Earth. So the Earth maybe had 90% of its final mass at that point, then it gained another 10% when this collision came along. Or it maybe it happened earlier on when the Earth maybe had only 60 or 70% of its
right,
final mass.
Right.
There's a lot of slop there, a lot of possibilities.
God, would you like to have been around to witness that, huh?
Well, if you were in a nice, warm, thermally protected spacecraft, you would not have wanted to be on Earth when that happened, because that collision would have made global warming look like a picnic in comparison.
If you were on the planet, and if you were live on the planet, and you were just looking into the sky as this other object was coming in, I mean, what would it look like, Alan? I mean, would it look...
It would have blocked out the entire sky, because this object would have been
huge.
Roughly the same size of the Earth, you know, something like one-half the size of the Earth is what we're talking about, to have something, 10% the mass of the Earth. This thing would have blotted out the entire sky, and once it would have hit, it would have launched a tremendous shockwave through the planet as well as through the atmosphere. In fact, it's believed that a good portion of the atmosphere, if Earth had an atmosphere at that point, would have been stripped off,
oh,
or at least
gosh.
On the side of the planet facing where the impact occurred. And it probably would have heated up the outer surface of the Earth to turn into what geophysicists call a magma ocean, which is what we think the moon had soon after it was formed. Basically, the entire outer, say, 1,000 kilometers or so of the Earth would have been a lava pool. So you, if you had been sitting on the Earth waiting for that to happen, you would have been counting down your seconds left of living, because things would have been all over for you quite quickly.
I would love to have a recording of what it would have sounded like.
A lot of screams, probably.
Jeez. You know, we've got a couple guests who've been on this program before, and... unfortunately, one has passed on, Tom Van Flandern, but their theory was that an object exploded with Mars, and, you know, that is what the asteroid belt is now. Will we ever get these real answers, Alan, to these kinds of questions?
I think the formation of the asteroid belt is reasonably well understood in the current theoretical models of how the solar system formed, at least. Folks like George Weatherall, who was a director at DTM who hired me a long time ago, he was really the pioneer of the field of trying to understand how the terrestrial planets formed. And he and other folks have been working on this problem for decades. And they showed quite clearly that the problem with not having any planets in the asteroid belt is simply that Jupiter formed. Once you form a Jupiter out at five times the Earth's sun distance, mm-hmm. then you go ahead, and it has to form early on, because Jupiter had to have formed rapidly while the gas was still in the
right.
planet-forming disk. Once you form Jupiter, then you go ahead and over the next 100 million years start building the terrestrial planets. Jupiter's gravitational pulls are so intense that anything which tries to form much farther out than Mars doesn't really have a chance to form. The bodies which are trying to hit each other and grow larger hit each other so hard that they actually fragment themselves into smaller bodies rather than growing larger. On the other hand, if you did a calculation where you said, hey, there's no Jupiter there at all, what happens? Well, then, hey, you get another Earth out at Jupiter's distance.
That's a good point. So, Alan, we're going to take this quick break, and we'll be back with you in just a moment as we talk about the crowded universe.